And our last word in business today is cheesy finance. If you're trying to figure out what's going on in Europe, look no farther than Swiss cheese, known as Emmental. It's one of Switzerland's biggest exports, but dairies there are feeling squeezed by their neighbors' financial problems. Not only are Italians and Spaniards buying less, Swiss cheese exporters are feeling the pain of a strong Swiss franc.
Here's the thing. Switzerland is not in the Eurozone, so investors have been parking their money in Swiss assets, which are seen as a safe haven, and that is pushing up the Swiss currency. So now when local exporters sell their cheese abroad, their profits sort of melt when brought back home and exchanged into francs.
One small dairy says its earnings per kilo have dropped nearly 30% compared to last year. The dairy's owner says he may be forced to cut back production to only a few wheels of cheese a day, and that would only be for the tourists who come through and want a photo op. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Blanc.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said today that the central bank will do all that it can to restore economic growth and jobs in the U.S. But he offered no specifics and made no promise of additional Fed action anytime soon. The stock market initially sank on the news, but later rallied, perhaps in response to Bernanke's forecast for long-term economic growth. From Jackson Hole, Wyoming, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Bernanke's speech had a gorgeous backdrop, the scenic Jackson Lake Lodge, the site of an annual policy conference. And the Fed chairman's long-range forecast was as bright as the morning sunshine, glinting off the Teton Range. But Bernanke also acknowledged economic clouds on the near horizon. Unemployment is still above 9%. And the Commerce Department said today the economy grew at a measly annual rate of 1% during the second quarter. Policymakers have tried to blame this sluggish recovery on temporary factors like the Japanese tsunami or the jump in oil prices that followed the Arab Spring. But Bernanke acknowledged today more persistent factors are also dragging the economy down, including the deep slump in the housing market. With that in mind, he said, Fed leaders are extending their September meeting for a second day, in which they'll discuss whether to use some of the additional tools available to them to stimulate the economy. Chief Economist Nariman Baravesh of the forecasting firm IHS Global Insight says the Fed's already worn out its biggest hammer, pounding short-term interest rates about as low as they'll go, and suggesting they'll stay there for two more years.
Clearly, the power of monetary policy is considerably diminished when interest rates get down close to zero. The Fed's not powerless here, but its powers are somewhat diminished just by virtue of the fact that we're in this very low interest rate world right now.
Some were hoping for more from Bernanke's speech today. At the same conference last year, he laid the groundwork for what became known as QE2, a strategy of aggressive bond buying that's credited with temporarily boosting the stock market. Since then, though, fears of inflation have resurfaced, and some politicians have begun to criticize the Fed for going too far. So Bernanke was cautious in his remarks today. He pointed out that a lot of economic policy is set not by the Fed, but by Congress and the White House. And he suggested short-term measures could help by putting more people back to work. Mohammed El Arian, who heads the giant PIMCO bond fund, says the recovery is fragile indeed.
We are right now in a very delicate situation. Think of the image of our economy is traveling on this very bumpy road and has used all its spare tires. In that circumstance, you do not want to blow a tire.
Bernanke said Congress and the White House didn't help matters with their recent fight over the debt ceiling, which rattled financial markets and probably hurt the economy. El Arian agrees with the Fed chairman, saying the government needs to do a better job of crafting economic policy.
Right now, most policymakers, with the exception of the Fed, are basically asleep at the wheel. We have seen very little policy actions out of Washington. We need a major reformulation of the policymaking process, because if we stay paralyzed like this, we will end up blowing quite a few tires, and we don't have many spares left on this car.
President Obama, who also likes automotive metaphors, is preparing to unveil his jobs proposal early next month. It's not clear in this political climate whether that plan will find any traction. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. We've been through a summer of movie sequels. Now comes a fall of movie remakes, including Straw Dogs, The Three Musketeers, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Our critic Bob Mondello was intrigued enough by this week's remake of a British gangster film called Brighton Rock that he decided to look at the old and the new side by side.
The 1947 Brighton Rock was black and white, based on a novel by Graham Greene about a character named Pinky Brown. Plenty colorful, in other words, a story set in a British resort town just before World War II.
More than ever,
playing Pinky, a violent, creepy 17-year-old gangster, was a baby-faced Richard Attenborough, the same guy who would later direct Gandhi and Cry Freedom, but who here was playing a real psychopath, chatting with his gangster buddies as he absentmindedly yanked out a doll's hair, strand by strand.
Now he can die.
Pinky's killed someone and will spend most of the film trying to cover his tracks. When he learns a pretty waitress named Rose could incriminate him, he sweet-talks her.
I like a girl who's friendly. You're sensitive like me. What's your name?
Rose.
You and me ought to get acquainted. You got a boy?
Not yet, I haven't.
So that she can't be forced to testify against him, Pinky will marry Rose, though sex repulses him, as does she, really. But with a woman's options being limited in the years before World War II, audiences knew she'd go along. The story turns darker and gets all tied up with sin and redemption as it progresses. Being Graham Greene characters, both Pinky and Rose are obsessed with Catholicism, though they come at it a little differently.
These atheists don't know nothing. Of course there's hell. Flames, damnations, torments.
Heaven too, Pinky.
Maybe.
At 92 minutes, the first Brighton Rock is snappy, well-acted, unnerving, pretty much a model gangster flick. So even all these years later, you need a reason to remake it. Director Rowan Jaffe's found several. He shot in color, not black and white, updated the story a few decades to the swinging 60s, and got Helen Mirren and John Hurt to take supporting roles.
I came as soon as I could. I thought
I'd live in fear of anything, except the atom bomb, of course. Certainly not a bunch of kids. One kid.
Brighton Pier doesn't look all that different, though it's actually Eastbourne Pier this time, but the people sure do. The town is overrun by rioting teenage mods and rockers.
Leave it to me, Pinky.
No, I'm running.
It's an era of social and sexual upheaval, providing new reasons for Pinky to feel insecure, and giving Rose more options. She could learn a trade, make her own way, not rely on Pinky, which makes her going along with him problematic. The film tries to solve that by playing her with more determination, more spunk. At one point, Pinky, played by Sam Riley, drags her furiously to the edge of a cliff, trying to frighten her.
Scared.
But she holds his gaze and melts him with her trust.
No one, I'm with you.
There's a lot of fancy filmmaking this time around, substituting for fancy writing the last time. Where the first film had a lawyer spouting Shakespeare, this one mostly has visual panache, crosses and crucifixes rather than dialogue about religion. You can't accuse the new film of being untrue to the original book. It actually reinstates the novel's climax, which Graham Greene had altered in his own screenplay, probably because it would have been tough to film back then. But what audiences will remember from both pictures isn't that scene, but the one that follows, an ending that Greene invented for the first movie to end it on an eerie note. It wouldn't be fair to reveal it, but if you're new to the story or have only read the novel, it'll likely strike you as it struck movie audiences then, as cruel and kind all at once, a persuasive illustration of what a character in the novel calls the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God. I'm Bob Mondello.
It's been a record-setting year for disasters in the U.S. There was a snowmageddon in the Northeast this winter, a huge number of deadly tornadoes in the spring. We had fires and drought and heat waves in the Southwest. record flooding on the Mississippi. And recently, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that so far, we've had 9 disasters totaling over $1 billion in damages each. That makes the total bill about $35 billion in damage. And we have barely scratched the hurricane season. Irene is headed up to wreak more havoc. Who knows how much damage we might see from hurricanes before this year is out. How do we track all of these disasters? Well, for a lot of them, we rely on satellites. But Congress has already slashed NOAA's budget, threatening the future of a pair of satellites that do precisely this sort of severe weather monitoring, helping us predict the strength of blizzards and tornadoes. So does this make any sense? Don't we need to keep tabs on impending weather disasters to know whom to evacuate and when? Joining me to talk about this is David Biello. He is an associate editor for Environment and Energy at Scientific American here in New York. He's in our New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
What kind of budget cutting are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about the same kind of general austerity that we've seen throughout the U.S. government. As you may have noticed,
there's been
a standoff across the board. And this is budget cutting not just for NOAA, but also for NASA. And this is an across-the-board cut in all of our Earth monitoring systems. And this is actually something that's been going on for about a decade now.
So NASA has satellites that look down on Earth, and they help us watch these different events, tornadoes and hurricanes and things?
Correct. We have two kinds of weather satellites. There are the ones that sit in what's called geostationary orbit. That means that they kind of sit there and take a picture of one hemisphere at a time. That gives you some information. And then we have these polar orbiting satellites. They go the opposite way. So they're kind of passing over the Earth while it's rotating past them underneath, and they give you a much more precise and detailed look at kind of rainfall and the other things we might like to know. Like, for example, it's how we know that Irene is probably going to dump about 8 inches of rainfall across the entire East Coast.
So the budget cuts would affect NASA and NOAA.
Correct. And like I said, this is something that's been going on for a long time. We have decided, I guess, as a government to abandon Earth observation in favor of things like Mars observation, and I would argue that perhaps we ought to pay more attention to our home rather than our neighbors.
Well, we had an earthquake and a hurricane in the same sort of week here. I think people might wake up a little bit on Capitol Hill.
I would hope so. I mean, I'm assuming that they're using these satellite forecasts to kind of plan their own travel, perhaps plan their own evacuation, perhaps batten down the hatches on their summer home. And I would think they would come to appreciate what could be lost. Now, this isn't something that's going to happen tomorrow. This is something that's going to happen over, say, the course of the next decade. NASA is launching in October. One of these satellites that would do this polar orbit that's so critical to kind of weather prediction. The problem is in more like 2016, 2018, the satellites that would be the successor to that program and continue and make sure that we continue our kind of eyes in the sky on that stuff would be the ones that were lost.
And so there's no money for that now?
There's no money for that. And so they're going to have to delay those by up to 2 years, the launch, in the hopes that some money would come later.
So we'll have a satellite gap.
Exactly. And we already have a satellite gap for certain things. There was a satellite called ICESat. As its name applies, it was keeping tabs on kind of the meltdown in Antarctica. Unfortunately, it reached the end of its design life and shut down. And there was no replacement because, like I said, during the Bush administration, we cut the money. We stopped putting these kinds of satellites up. And they've now replaced that with a plane. For weather observation.
A plane.
Yes, an airplane flying through.
Hope it flies fast.
Yeah, flying through polar weather. That's not ideal conditions, as you can imagine.
Yes, I've been there.
And the only possible replacement for these weather satellites are weather balloons. So, again, we'd be going
back to the future.
It's back to 1850 again. Yeah, so it's, there's no good answer for this because we have fallen so far behind on our Earth observations. I think there are about 15 satellite systems, including this weather one. 14 out of the 15 are past their design life, and will shut down shortly, and they will not be replaced. You might be familiar with Landsat, which has given this huge data set over many, many years. The latest iteration of that is reaching the end of its life and may or may not be replaced. One of the things that is kind of overlooked in this is that it's very difficult to match up data sets between different satellite programs. So you kind of want that continuity so that you know that you're measuring always the same thing. That helps with things like climate change that are perhaps politically sensitive.
Okay, is that one of the reasons they did away with, or not, I shouldn't say do away, they're not going to fund a new satellite, that they don't want climate change to be part of this?
Certainly that has been the first thing to go each and every time this has happened. So, for example, this satellite going up in October used to be planned to have this whole array of sensors that were going to tell us a lot about climate change. Those are all gone for budget cuts. So it's only going to do the weather.
So they in the allocation, it says no it's sensing not that for climate.
Yeah, no, it's not that the allocation. It's that we're only going to give you, say, $1 million, but in order to have the climate sensors, we need $2 million. So what do you do?
Well,
it's not the climate sensors.
It's not changing. Why do we need?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Why do we need it? Could other nations help us fill in the gap in this satellite?
Other nations actually already are helping to fill in the gap. First of all, the military is helping fill in the gap. They have military weather satellites that are doing this polar orbiting. Because obviously the military has a vested interest in knowing what the weather's going to be.
I think so.
The Europeans also have some, and they help us with some of the rest of the day. But we're the only ones who are doing kind of the late afternoon to evening shift with these weather satellites, and we will just lose that information.
Well, you know, the Chinese own a lot of our debt. Why don't we have them help us fill in the satellite gap?
I know. We owe them a lot of money.
They should invest some of that back in the satellite.
Unfortunately, there is actually a law now that was just passed that NASA is not allowed by law to participate in any joint ventures with China whatsoever. So that won't be happening anytime soon. Yeah, your guess is as good as mine why that should be.
No joint ventures between NASA and China.
Correct. So we're limited to the Europeans.
Even if I wanted a common tour of the country, I mean, I couldn't bring them over on a joint venture.
Well, not if you're NASA.
If I wanted to take them to Times Square, I couldn't.
Not for NASA.
Not for NASA.
Yeah.
It used to be with the Russians. Now we're talking about the Chinese.
It's definitely very, very Cold War.
Wow. And so we have this gap coming up that we might be without these satellites for a while. And do you think this could change as an observer? Do you think this focus that we shine some light on this might change?
It will be a momentary light based on past experience. Once Irene kind of blows over, people will relatively quickly forget why we spend a relatively small amount of money on satellites so we can know about Hurricane Irene before it hits us. I mean, we have 36 hours to prepare, right?
Right.
That's thanks to satellites.
All right. You've summed that up, David. Thank you very, very much. David Biello is an associate editor for Environment and Energy at Scientific American here in New York. And wishing you a safe weekend.
Same to you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. As we've been reporting, President Obama is ending his vacation early and coming back to Washington tonight as Hurricane Irene heads for the eastern seaboard. That's one powerful concern on the president's mind. Also troubling, no doubt, recent poll numbers that show Americans are widely and strongly discontented with his performance. For our Friday political conversation, I'm joined by New York Times columnist David Brooks. David, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And today, sitting in for E.J. Dionne, Joyanne Reed, managing editor for thegrio.com. That's an NBC news site focused on the African American community. Joyanne, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
What about the poll numbers that we're seeing? President Obama's job approval rating is at one of the lowest points of his presidency. We talked yesterday on the program about a Pew Research Center poll. They are seeing what they call a big intensity gap, David. 38% of people now strongly disapprove of his performance. David, what do those numbers signal to you?
Well, the interesting thing to me is after he lost the 2010 election, after Democrats lost, they made some adjustments. They did move to the center. They did some things during the budget fight, which were sort of moderate, hoping to win back those independent voters. And so far, if you look at the polls of 2011, they don't seem to have moved much. That the shifts that took place in 2009 really haven't really been abated, and that's sort of bad news. The second thing is there's sort of a loss of focus. If you look at the president's campaign in 2008, he told Exodus stories. It was a story of a narrative of people coming to together. And that unified his campaign and inspired a lot of people. I'm not sure what unifying narrative they've come up with for the next time, something that will have to be a battered fighter who's still on your side. So far, they haven't come up with that narrative.
Joanne Reed, do you think that's a fatal problem for President Obama and his campaign staff?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, one of the problems that the Obama campaign has had is that ever since he came into office, the American people wanted to talk about jobs, right? They wanted to talk about jobs, and maybe mortgages. Those were the two hot topics. But we spent the first 2 years going on about health care and sort of dragging through a big fight about that. And then we moved on to financial reform. And then we've spent the last year talking about deficits and spending. And deficits and spending fascinates the Beltway and fascinates the media, but the American people are not interested in that so much as they are, again, about jobs. And I think what we're seeing for the Obama numbers is this long, slow drip of people just being fed up at the jobs picture and the economy for them personally, not feeling like it's improving and not feeling like Washington is on message, right? So on the one hand, I think his problem is that jobs number, that lingering, nagging ache over the economy. But on the other hand, if you look at the AP GFK poll, it's incredible how actually remarkably stable the president's reelect number is. It's gone down exactly 1 point since the last time they took the poll. And I think the other issue for Republicans, what they have to look at is that they're not benefiting from people's long, slow ache on the economy. Because when people look at Republicans, they like them even worse. And when they look at the Tea Party, they like them the least of all. So I think that for the Obama administration, the blessing for them in all of this is the existence of the Tea Party.
Now, on the Republican side, we have seen a number of polls now showing Texas Governor Rick Perry vaulting ahead of the presumed GOP frontrunner, Mitt Romney. David Brooks, do you see Romney maybe tilting further to the right to more directly take on Rick Perry and try to turn those numbers around?
Yeah, they're having a debate in Romney camp what to do because the Perry numbers are broad and they're real and they're, I think, probably permanent. You know, there are two courses. One is just hope the guy implodes. He's kind of a loudmouth.
Rick Perry.
Rick Perry implodes. And I think they're going to do that. And I guess I would do that through September. There are going to be three presidential debates. See how Perry does in those. But I think it's more likely than not that Romney's going to have to go after Perry. And it would be a mistake to try to out-conservative him. Romney's A, terrible at that. B, it would offend people who are Republican primary voters. He has to find some other tack. And I think the two tacks to take is to point out that Perry uses campaign money as a governing and a political tool. And that reminds people of Tom DeLay. The second thing is, if this is a war on Washington and the enemy is or the opponents are Nancy Pelosi, then Perry's going to win. But if Romney can shift it to a discussion about America's place in the world, competition against China and India, then he seems like, I think, a more responsible steward, and that's more his natural ground. But so for a little while, they're going to do nothing. Then I think they're going to have to prove – Romney's going to have to prove his toughness and go on the attack.
And Joanne Reed, what do you think about what David is proposing there as a strategy for Mitt Romney if he wants to take on Rick Perry?
Well, I think it sounds like a fine strategy. I don't think it's going to work. The way I'm reading the Republican base right now, I don't think they want a responsible steward. They want a firebrand evangelical preacher that's going to bring back what they see as the good old days of America before it was burdened down by horrible entitlements and the minimum wage and all of these ghastly liberal policies that the Tea Party Republicans want gotten rid of. I don't think the base is paying attention to the specifics about Rick Perry. I think they just like Rick Perry. He's sort of a real George W. Bush, right? He's a real rancher, where Bush was kind of a faux rancher. You know, he's a five-generation Texan, whereas Bush acquired being a Texan. And I think that he is sort of reminiscent of the Bush they liked in 2000. And he's not really a patrician like Bush. So I actually think that Romney is in trouble here. He took too long to recognize the threat of Rick Perry coming in. And now Perry is gobbling up Michelle Bachmann's support, and he's consolidating kind of that far-right base that really runs the Republican Party now.
David, your column today in the New York Times is headlined, President Rick Perry? And you write, it's time to take Perry seriously. He could be our next president. Does he have, do you think, the broader appeal to capture not just the Republican Party base in the primaries, but independent votes, Democratic votes that could vault him in a general election to the presidency?
I think he would face greater challenges than some of the other candidates, Mitt Romney or John Huntsman. But I do think if he wins the Republican nomination, it's going to be a race about Obama. And Obama's weak. And if you look at the head-to-head polls, Perry's right there with him. 46 or so in the most recent Gallup poll. So I think he's not certainly not the most electable, but a lot of people are too quick to say there's no way that guy could win a general election. I think if he had a general election, the country has shifted to the right since 2008. Not as much as the Republican Party has, but it has shifted. And Perry could win a fall election.
Joy-Ann Reid, what do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting if this were 2010, maybe, but the difference between a midterm electorate and a general election electorate is quite vast. A 2010-style electorate is whiter and older and is more Tea Party. And so, of course, if you look at it that way, yeah, Perry would be electable. But what's happened is that part of the Republican Party that's taken over is really turning off the American people. The polls show that the intensity of dislike of the Tea Party is growing very quickly. Perry, he sounds good to that part of the base, but I think when you get into a general election, a guy who has spoken favorably about secession, a guy who, at least according to a political report, is confabbing with a faux historian who claims that slavery was forced on us by the British and you shouldn't really credit civil rights leaders for ending, what was segregation in the United States. I mean, a guy who talks with that extreme rhetoric, I don't think is going to play very well in a general electorate that is tired of the far right stopping what they see as, attempts at progress in Washington.
Okay. Joy-Ann Reid of TheGrio.com, David Brooks of The New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Time now for our monthly episode of Science Diction, where we talk about the origins of scientific words with my guest Howard Markel, professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. They should combine those names, make it easier to say. Hi, Howard.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
How are you? What's our word today?
Well, the word today is chemistry.
We have chemistry.
We have
you and I have some chemistry.
We do. There's a lot of argument. We've all taken chemistry in high school, and some of us have even taken it in college. But there's a great deal of controversy. Did it come from ancient Egypt or from ancient Greece? Now, some have claimed that there's an Egyptian origin. Back in 300 A.D., a Roman emperor, Diocletian, decreed that the burning of all Egyptian writings that outlined the transmutation of gold into silver. Mm. And based on this edict, as well as several hieroglyphic inscriptions, people such as Plutarch in 100 A.D. insisted that the root word chem was derived from the name of ancient Egypt, which was called the land of chem, or alchemia. And that really means rich black soil, the type of soil that flourished near the banks of the Nile and was prized for its fertility as opposed to the sands of the surrounding desert. But the Oxford English Dictionary, on the other hand, declares that the word is more likely the child of Greek roots, chemia, which means pouring or infusion. And the ancient Greeks applied this term to what we would call pharmaceutical chemistry. The physicians would extract juices or infusions of plants for medicinal purposes. Now, for many centuries, chemistry and alchemy were practically interchangeable for Egyptians, Persians, Greeks, Romans, and later Europeans, well into the 16th century. And the goal was to discover or create a mythical philosopher's stone that could turn base metals into gold and silver, and also act as an elixir that would magically cure all of one's ills and grant us eternal youth. But there was also a wonderful set of philosophies attached to alchemy that would concern your own transformation into a virtuous person. And that continued all the way into the psychoanalytical writings of Carl Jung. I should mention, by the way, that the original Harry Potter book, the first one in keeping with its alchemical theme, was called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. But despite its runaway success in Great Britain, the U.S. publisher changed it to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone because they believed that no American child would buy a book containing the word philosopher.
Heavens forbid.
But later on, in the 17th century on, a great many natural philosophers and alchemists, including Robert Boyle, began to rethink the field, and they wanted to apply physical methods to study matter. And in fact, Robert Boyle wrote a 1661 treatise called The Skeptical Chemist, and he renamed the field chemistry. And he's known for a lot of things, best known for Boyle's law, right, the inversely proportional relationship between the absolute pressure and volume of a gas. And as the centuries proceeded, there was a whole host of scientific revolutionaries, Lavoisier, John Dalton, and many others, and they developed what we know now as modern chemistry, which is a quantitative and reproducible framework for understanding not only the composition of matter, but also how matter can change forms by means of chemical reactions. So it's been some time since we've discarded the teachings of alchemy and the Philosopher's Stone and all that wonderful mysticism about transforming not only lead into gold, but ourselves. Unless, that is, you're a graduate of the prestigious Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. It's still taught there, I'm told.
Well, Howard, you know how to sum the whole thing up very, very well and bring it up today. Thank you very much. Fascinating history.
Well, thanks for having me.
And have a good weekend to you.
You too. Have a safe one.
Yeah, we'll do the best we can. Thanks a lot, Howard.
Okay.
Howard Markel, professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help from NPR librarian Keith Maleski. If you missed any part of our program or others, go to iTunes. You can subscribe to our podcast. We have audio and video ones. Also, we have an Android app. You can download that and get our programming from there. Go to our website and leave us a message over there and talk to the folks who are talking about and commenting on our website, too. And you can go to our Facebook page at Facebook/SciFry and join the discussions going on there also. Get ready for this one. Have a safe weekend. Prepare yourselves because we want to see you here back safe and sound next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.